Hello and welcome to another weekly podcast from Hilltop United Methodist Church in Mankato, Minnesota. If you're in the Mankato area, join us every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. and again at 10:30 a.m. If you'd like to learn more, visit us at mankatohilltop.org. Best of all,
God is with us.
Well, here we are in a new sermon series, Mosaic Faith, talking about the book of Exodus and the Israelite people. Before we jump into that, I just want to just give a couple things here. First of all, number one, can we give thanks to Barb? Barb, who she's back in the booth. Barb, she preached last week. If you missed last week, you can find it on YouTube. You can listen to it on the Mankato Hilltop podcast. That's how I listened to it. You got to hear a bit of Barb's faith journey as a person married to a clergy person and where that took them all over the world and how God is continuing to lead her even now in retirement through acts of social justice and putting her faith involved in that way. So thank you, Barb, last week. Now, I was gone chasing the eclipse. It feels like it was a long time ago now, but you know that there was an eclipse that was happening. You heard all about it. You couldn't see it in Mankato. Julie and I drove about 1,200 miles in 2 days, all the way down to almost the near southern tip of Illinois so that we could go see the eclipse. I have a couple of pictures here. This is us waiting in the field at Chester, Illinois, along the Mississippi River. We put those glasses on, you can't really see, so I'm kind of like staring at this face in this picture. I'm not sure what's going on there. But let me tell you, it was a very moving and exciting experience. Has anyone ever seen a total eclipse, a total solar eclipse? Okay, just a couple. Yeah, just a couple. There was one a few years ago in Nebraska, and then we decided to head down. And this is kind of what it looks like. There's no way to take a picture to describe what happens when there's a total solar eclipse. I'll probably have much more to say about this later. I'm still kind of processing that experience. But where we were, there were 3 minutes and 24 seconds of totality. So yes, we drove 1,200 miles for 3.5 minutes of totality. But let me tell you what's worth it. Here's another picture of us here. You can't even see, but the sun is blocked out there by the moon, and it's still pretty bright when you try to take a picture of it with your cell phone. This is just taking a picture with your cell phone. If we were to zoom in on the picture, you'd see this. And what's really neat about that is everything goes dark in the middle of the day. And the dogs are like, what is going on? And they bark everywhere, and the birds come out, and the crickets come out thinking it's nighttime. Just a really fascinating and wonderful experience. And then I decided to get in the truck with my boat and my good buddy Jeff Adams. You know Jeff Adams. He's married to Paulette, our choir director. And we went fishing. The fishing was actually pretty bad. We went fishing in South Dakota. However, we did catch a couple of nice fish here. I'm going to show you those pictures. That's a 26-inch walleye. Jeff's got about a 27 or 28-inch northern pike. So we did catch a couple of wonderful fish in South Dakota. All right. Well, here we go into a new sermon series. And again, congregation, thank you for letting me get away. This really means a lot to our family, and to hang out with friends and family. It was a wonderful time away. So, all right, let's jump into Exodus. What are some small, what seemingly seems like insignificant events that have happened that have really changed your life, our world? What are some of those? Just think about that for a minute. What are some of those small little events? There's actually a person, Gavrilo Princip. Who is that? Do you know that name? Have you heard that? A small, insignificant, well, at the time it seemed a little insignificant, but actually changed the course of human history. He did. Gavrilo Princip. He's the young Serbian man who shot Archduke Franz Ferdinand on June 28th, 1914. What does that mean? A lot of people talk about that as being the start of what was at that point in time called the Great War. The Great War. See, Franz Ferdinand was the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, and his wife, the Duchess of Homburg, they were killed by princeps bullets. And actually, they had just escaped an assassination. There was a bombing attempt that had happened just a few hours before, and they quickly got on the carriage and were trying to get out of town, and the assassins who were organizing these young Serbian people then tried to get ahead of where their carriage was going to be, and Gavrilo Princip was there with his gun and was able to shoot the Archduke and his wife. At that moment, the world changed. At that moment. The political objectives of the assassination was to free Bosnia and Herzegovina of the Austro-Hungarian rule, to establish a common South Slav or Yugoslav state. That eventually did happen. The state of Yugoslavia was eventually established much later. But this assassination precipitated the July crisis, which led Austro-Hungary to declare war on Serbia, and then the chips just fell from there. And pretty soon all of Europe was embroiled in a war. The course of history can change with what seems like a very small or insignificant act. Some people think that there's some of those acts that have happened recently. I don't know, we're still living in it. Was January 6th one of those days? I don't know. We're still trying to find out. What course of history will play out and look back on what's happening in our world? You know, small, insignificant, but then they have this broad effect. Certainly technology like the smartphone or artificial intelligence. Oh my goodness. Is it going to rock our world or what? I don't know. Seemingly somewhat insignificant things. We all just say, hey Siri, look up this thing for us. What will the world be like in the future? These small, similar, they seem insignificant. But the course of history can change with something just very small. Or at least it seems small at the time. We don't know exactly how significant it is. And that's exactly how the book of Exodus starts. It starts with some seemingly insignificant things that are going to have this huge consequential effect on the Israelite people. So I'm going to read through Exodus chapter 1. If you got your Bibles and you want to follow along, that's fine. It's going to be on the screen. We're just going to take it in some chunks as we read Exodus 1 and unpack some of the history and unpack what's happening. Because someone dies and it changes the course of all of the Israelite people. And this book of Exodus becomes very foundational, not just for Jews, but for Christians. So much of the New Testament calls back to this history. And you know some of it. I know you know some of it, right? Moses, and you're already picturing Charlton Heston, right? He's standing in front of the Red Sea. Let my people go. And they open the sea and the chariots. You know the movies. You know the history. But let's read the text and understand this story deeper, because it helps us understand how to be better Christians. And these small little insignificant acts have big consequences as the book plays out. Here we go. Exodus chapter 1. Verse 1. These are the names of the Israelites who came to Egypt with Jacob, along with their households: Reuben, Simon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. The total number in Jacob's family was 70. Joseph was already in Egypt. Eventually, Joseph, his brothers, and everyone in his generation died. But the Israelites were fertile and became populous. They multiplied and grew dramatically, filling the whole land. All right. So we need to understand just a little bit of this history. It goes all the way back to Genesis, the book which is right before Exodus. In Genesis, it starts with the history of creation, and then there's the first person who comes on the scene who God calls out of his land, out of his people, and that's Abraham. And he says what to Abraham? I'm going to make a great nation out of you. But even before that starts, God tells everyone in the world, in the very first chapter of Genesis, after he creates men and women, and he says, you are created in the image of God, and he says, go forth, and here it is. God blessed them and said to them, be fertile and multiply, fill the land and master it. That's exactly what Exodus starts with. In verse 7, it said, they were plentiful and they filled the whole land. What were they doing? They were following God's call. They were following God's call in Genesis to go forth, populate the land, fill it up, be the people of God. So it's a callback to the creation account of how they're trying at that time to be faithful to what God has done to them. Exodus is also going to move the narrative of God's people from a family to a nation. How does God do that? How does God take it from just a family to a whole nation? Well, first of all, Abraham, what does God say to Abraham? Let's look at that real quick. It's in Genesis chapter 12. The Lord said to Abram, "Leave your land, your family, leave your father's household for the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation and bless you. I will make your name respected and you will be a blessing." You've heard that before, I think, if you've studied the Bible. I'm going to create a great name. How does God do that? That's Exodus. Exodus is the story of that. See, at the beginning of Genesis, it's Abram, Isaac, and Jacob. That's a family. That's a family lineage. It's a family tree. When we get to Exodus and they've been fruitful and multiplied, they're no longer just a family. They are a nation. They are a people. They go from being a small, localized little group to the nation of Israel. How did the Israelites end up in Egypt? You know this story, maybe, maybe not. Okay, that's the Genesis story of Joseph. Oh, we could preach a whole sermon series on Joseph. He's a very interesting guy. You know the Technicolor Dreamcoat guy? Yeah, and all the 12 tribes of Israel who come from Jacob, his dad. So they kick him out. He gets carried off into Egypt. And what happens when he's in Egypt? He becomes in charge of the nation of Egypt. He's the royal vizier of the Egyptian king. He moves from being imprisoned to now in the government of Egypt. And then his brothers come. We could spend a whole time talking about this, but his brothers end up in Egypt and he saves them. And then all the Israelite people end up in Egypt. How? Through Joseph, the son of Jacob. Jacob, who later is renamed Israel. Okay, see how this thing is starting to click together here? I just want to make sure we're all tracking on the history of this. So eventually the lineage of Jacob, Joseph, and all of his brothers, the 12 tribes of the Hebrew people, they continue to populate in Egypt. They're in Egypt because Joseph has been there. He's been in charge. The first Hebrews were the ones who carried the lineage that started with Abraham. Now you hear me saying a couple different words here. Israelite, Hebrew. Israelite, Hebrew. What's the difference? Typically speaking, the word Hebrew is used for when the people are not in their land. When they're in diaspora, when they're away from Israel, Palestine, they're called the Hebrew people. When they're in the land, they're called the Israelite people. So back and forth, it means the same thing, whether you say Hebrews or Israelites. But that's a little bit of a difference of how they're related to each other. Let's continue on now. We find out that Joseph is gone. The people are in Egypt. All of the people, all Joseph, his brothers, his dad Jacob, all of them, they've all died. The king that Joseph was working for, he's dead. And now there's a new king. Here it is, right here, verse 8, where we left off. Now a new king came to power in Egypt who didn't know Joseph. Okay, our red flag should be going up there. Uh-oh. He said to these people, "The Israelite people are no longer, the Israelite people are now larger in number and stronger than we are. Come on, let's be smart and deal with them. Otherwise, they will only grow in number, and if war breaks out, they will join our enemies, fight against us, and then escape from the land." As a result, the Egyptians put foremen of forced work gangs over the Israelites to harass them with hard work. They had to build storage cities named Pithom and Ramses for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they grew and spread. So much so that the Egyptians started to look at the Israelites with disgust and dread. So the Egyptians enslaved the Israelites. They made their lives miserable with hard labor, making mortar and bricks, doing field work, and by forcing them to do all kinds of other cruel work. This is a recounting of how the Hebrew people, who started out having the blessing of the Egyptian king with Joseph, now became enslaved under this new king who didn't know Joseph, who didn't know the history. And what happens? The Israelites were carrying out what God had commanded them to do in Genesis, be fruitful and multiply. That's what they were doing, being fruitful and multiplying. And what happens? The king gets scared. You can hear it. You can feel it. Empires, the Egyptian empire, any empire, always seeks to have dominion over the hearts and minds of its subjects. In an empire, that's what happens. We will see as we read the text that many of the Hebrews resisted this enforcement against them. Empires, like the Austro-Hungarian Empire, seeks to squash the people underneath them. Do you see some of the similarities? It's not quite a one for one, but that's how empires work. Empires work like, hey, we're going to take control of this situation. But you can only do that for so long. Why? Because people will always naturally resist. It's the message of Star Wars. Have you seen Star Wars? We know so many great movies of this, right? Empire, domination. Listen to me, do what I say. But that you cannot force people into situations. The king of Egypt here, this new Pharaoh, he cannot force the Israelites. He's going to try. He's going to try to force them into this. But all throughout human history, the people always have had a chance to rise up. To rise up and resist the oppression of empires. I merely point it out here because when one group tries to use power and control, when that one group feels threatened by another group, and sometimes that other group is very much less powerful. They were slaves. They were less powerful. But they had many more members. Our natural instinct is to use whatever power or force we have to force people into our way of thinking. Force people into our way of empire. I don't know. Is this playing out in our world today? Do we see some friction with this? Same kind of thing sometimes. Forcing people, you need to behave this way, you need to think this way, you need to vote this way, you need to... Guess what? It's not going to work. You can try and force. There's only so long that you can force before people rise up. So in this case, Pharaoh uses his power to enslave people. He uses his power to make life miserable. And think about this. They are working in the brick factories of Egypt under the blaring sun. That's about the worst job you could have. And eventually they take away the straw. We're not to that part yet. But can you imagine just coming home caked in mud, working in 110, 120 degrees, building? I mean, it just sounds horrible, doesn't it? And in verse 8, it talks about how the king arose who didn't know Joseph, didn't know the history, didn't know what was happening with the people, the accommodation they had when Joseph was there. It's kind of interesting to think when the king did know Joseph, when the king did understand, they were on good terms, weren't they? But as soon as that institutional memory is gone, how quickly that changes. How quickly that changes. We see clearly that the story of the king of Egypt is making some decisions based on how he is really afraid. He's worried. Well, he's worried of what? They're going to grow. They're going to take over. They're going to become more powerful. So this fear then drives him. It drives everything he does. Man, that's our temptation. That is always our temptation, to give in to fear. Even if we're not the king of Egypt. Oh my goodness, the world is scary. Ah! Give in to control and power. That's the temptation we always have. But what we're going to see in the story is it's in the face of fear and temptation, there's a faithfulness that God provides. There's a faithfulness to his mission, to his ministry, that helps them get through enslavement, fear, oppression, all these difficult things, way more difficult than anything you and I ever have to face. And you think, how could they ever do that? Because they trusted in God. Isn't it interesting that for generations, they could work together with Joseph, who was trusting in God and following God's commands, working with the previous king. But as soon as a new leader comes in, and in this case, comes to power and is faced with fear, how it switches. I mean, it's just like a 180. They go from like working in the king's household to not. This has happened throughout history, The Qing dynasty, the Qin, Q-I-N, dynasty in China, Emperor Nero, Genghis Khan, Ivan the Terrible, Joseph Stalin, Pol Pot, Kim Jong-il, on and on we could go, right? The leader feels threatened. What happens? Enslave the people. Such is the way of worldly power. So this worldly power gets even more brutal as the chapter goes on. When the power of slavery and oppression do not meet the goals, Pharaoh becomes even more desperate. What does he do? Let's pick it up. Verse 15. The king of Egypt spoke to two Hebrew midwives named Shiphrah and Puah. When you are helping the Hebrew women give birth and you see the baby being born, if it's a boy, kill him. But if it's a girl, you can let her live. Now the two midwives respected God, so they didn't obey the Egyptian king's order. Instead, they let the baby boys live. So the king of Egypt called the two midwives and said to them, "Why are you doing this? Why are you letting the baby boys live?" The two midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because Hebrew women aren't like Egyptian women. They're much stronger and give birth before the midwives can get to them." So God treated the midwives well, and the people kept on multiplying and became very strong. And because the midwives respected God, God gave them households of their own. Then Pharaoh gave an order to all of his people, "Throw every baby boy born to the Hebrews into the Nile River, but you can let all the girls live." May God add a blessing to the reading, hearing, and understanding of Holy Scripture. And that's how chapter 1 ends. Horrible situation. Because when fear and enslavement doesn't work, it leads to what? Killing. Killing. Same thing happens with leaders in our day. When war and enslavement doesn't work, you're not going to listen to my voice, you're not going to follow my oppression, then our country is going to invade your country. I don't know, is that happening in our world today? You know what I mean? Do you see how this plays out? Sort of like this cycle that always happens in our world from time to time. Maybe we're living in another one of those cycles. I don't know. But God protected the people. And in fact, what happened? You saw in the text, it said, it made them stronger. How did they get stronger? In the face of oppression. What was that all about? Why? Their faithfulness. Their faithfulness, even in the midst of oppression. Even when it was very hard. The strength didn't come from them. It wasn't anything that they did. It was their trust in who God was and what God was doing in their midst. And even when things got to their worst, and Pharaoh said, "You better kill all those little boys," the faith carried those women, the midwives, to be faithful in the midst of that. When Joseph died, it was kind of like a small act at the time. Like, what happened? He got old and he died. We don't really know about his death. But eventually, it really changed the course for the Israelite people. These small events can have long-lasting effects, sometimes when we don't even know it. But in the midst of those events, in the midst of whatever chaos is thrown at the people, and can you imagine being an Israelite? You don't know that all of a sudden, boom, you're going to be oppressed. One day we're in favor, the next we're not. So it doesn't quite happen, you know, that quickly, but over a generation, they go from being in favor with the king to out of favor with the king. But what never wavered in this instance right here at the beginning is their faithfulness. Now their faithfulness will be tested over and over as the book goes on. But we hear about these faithful midwives, about what God protected them. God strengthened them. God gave them favor. Not by anything that they did, but by remaining faithful to who God is and God's call to them. So these small events, whatever they are, in the beginning of this book, now are going to shape the rest. Because the first question you're asking yourself is, who's going to lead these people? That's the story of Moses. That's the story of who Moses is. And that's where we'll talk about it next week in chapter 2. That's when Moses is born. And we'll look at that story about what happens and how God is faithful in the midst of that. Now, I want to invite everyone here Everyone. If you want to, on Tuesdays, we're going to talk about this. We have a Bible study set up. It's going to be on Tuesdays at 6:30. You're welcome to come. We're going to meet in the back classroom, and we're going to read Exodus and talk through this. So there's a new Bible study kicking off this week, and if you want to be a part of this and take the sermon a little bit deeper, we'll be doing that this week on Tuesday nights at 6:30. Everyone's welcome to come. So
thanks for listening to another podcast from Hilltop United Methodist Church in Mankato, Minnesota. Don't forget to visit us online at mankatohilltop.org.